I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Sex trafficking is a global enterprise with estimated profits of $99 billion a year. It's a crime that is often hidden in plain sight and whose victims know no bounds of class, race, or gender, but have disparities in race, gender, and power allowed this form of modern slavery to thrive. On today's installment of Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks, why do federal authorities charge more people with sex trafficking in Maryland than in almost any other jurisdiction? Jessica Emerson is the director of the Human Trafficking Prevention Project at the University of Baltimore. Jean Alert is the founder of the Samaritan Women Institute for Shelter Care. They join us when Midday gets underway, right after these headlines. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall, and today it's Midday Culture Connections. We're going to talk about the huge problem of sex trafficking in the Mid-Atlantic region and around the country. A word of caution, our conversation will likely not be appropriate for young listeners and for others for whom this subject may be difficult to talk about. In the United States, the underground economy of commercial sexual exploitation is thriving. While the overwhelming majority of victims are women and girls, men and boys are often trafficked as well. Victims include American citizens as well as foreign nationals. They are from diverse economic and ethnic backgrounds, and they come from rural, urban, and suburban areas. Trafficking can take place anywhere: hotels, private parties, on the streets, in brothels, and even in victims' homes. The internet is the primary driver for sex traffickers. Internet-based commercial sex makes up a staggering 87.7% of active cases. So who are the victims? How are they being trafficked? And what does it take to rescue them, to help them recover, and to prosecute the traffickers? As always on Midday Culture Connections, I'm joined in Studio A by Dr. Sherry Parks. She's the Vice President for Strategic Initiatives at the Maryland Institute College of Art. Sherry, how you doing?
Hi there.
And a little later, we'll be joined by Jean Alert, the founder and executive director of the Samaritan Women Institute for Shelter Care. That's a local organization focused on the rehabilitation of victims of sex trafficking from around the country. But we begin with Jessica Emerson of the University of Baltimore School of Law. She's the founder of the Human Trafficking Prevention Project at UB. Jessica, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
And listeners, if you'd like to contribute to our conversation, our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, to send us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR. And we are also streaming our conversation on the WYPR Facebook page. So, Jessica Emerson, the Trafficking Victims Protection Act of 2000 is now 18, 19 years old. It's the first federal law to address trafficking, but the trafficking continues, and it seems to have even increased considerably since 2000. What's going on?
Well, I don't know if I would agree that it has increased. I think it's kind of a situation where we just see it and know it's happening.
So we're aware.
Yeah, when we name something, we see it more. You know, the question of whether, you know, there were as many cases of autism before we knew what autism was. but we definitely know what it is. We have definitely created structures at the state, local, and federal levels to address it, both in terms of prosecuting perpetrators as well as working with the survivors.
And Sherry, I mean, the prostitution, I suppose, has been called, you know, glibly the world's oldest profession or something. I mean, is this something in terms of cultural awareness that has undergone an evolution, do you think?
Well, I think even, I mean, what Jessica just pointed out is that there was a dawning recognition and then a law and then an increasing recognition. And yet we have not managed to decrease it, it seems. And it's important right now to make a difference between, and we won't spend a lot of time talking about prostitution per se, between prostitution and trafficking, because the level of control and coercion, and there are lots of ways of coercion, are really important to this discussion.
Yeah, and that is a really crucial distinction. So it's certainly there are prostitutes who are trafficked, but prostitution and trafficking are very different things. What qualifies in the legal sense as trafficking?
Right. So I just want to reiterate, they are not the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
prostitution is a crime in the majority of the country, and it involves trading sex or a sex act for money or something of value. When that act is induced by force, fraud, or coercion, or when the individual engaging in that commercial sex act is under the age of 18, that is then defined as trafficking. And it's really important to recognize that although the focus tends to be overwhelmingly on sex trafficking, what we know about kind of global patterns is that trafficking into other forms of labor is far more prevalent.
More prevalent,
more
than
prevalent.
Sexual exploitation.
Absolutely.
I was amazed to read from the guidelines set up by the Maryland Human Trafficking Task Force, which has been set up by the governor and the legislature, that sex trafficking does not require the movement of an individual. That's really interesting because you think of trafficking as, you know, taking a person from one place to another against her will for whatever. But this doesn't always, it's
right.
Not always the case.
It unfortunately shares its name with what we get stuck in at rush hour. So we automatically assume that it means moving people. And there is really, I think, understandably, confusion between human trafficking and human smuggling. Human smuggling requires the movement of a body across an international boundary. So that requires movement, but that can be consented to. I can want to get from one country to another, but I can't do so legally. And so I consent to being smuggled across the border, right? Human trafficking does not require movement in any way, shape, or form. It tends to include that. We tend to see that. And that has to do with a lot of different things. I mean, first of all, if you're doing something illegal, I would assume it's probably best to keep it moving so that no one catches up with you in terms of law enforcement. But it's also, movement is also a way that you can keep control of a victim. Because if I take someone from a community that they're comfortable in, that they know, where to find support and services, where their family members are, whatever it is, and I take them to somewhere that they don't know where any of those things are, that's a very easy way to control them. So we tend to see movement as it relates to trafficking, but it is not required. So you're right. When it comes to trafficking, people can be trafficked from one country to another, one state to another, one city to another, within their own city or within their own home. The key piece is the force, fraud, or coercion.
And just to be clear, anytime the victim is under the age of 18, it's sex trafficking. There's no such thing as consent for a 16-year-old.
According to federal and state law, yes.
And how has federal and state law, let's talk a little bit about what happened just in this last session here with the Maryland General Assembly. I mean, mm-hmm. a number of bills around this issue came up. Some succeeded, others did not.
Most succeeded. Actually. And I'm at the point where a week plus out, so I can talk about this without shaking and sweating from the exertion of the legislative session. So the priorities of the Maryland Human Trafficking Task Force, there were four priority bills, three of which passed and one of which got further than it ever had. One of the now laws that passed had to do with the issue of minors. So there was a bill that was passed, SB 688 and HB 827. We call it a safe harbor law. These laws originated in my home state of New York in 2008. And essentially what they do is decriminalize the act of prostitution for minors, either through complete immunity from prosecution or through diversion to some form of services. The bill in Maryland contained both supportive services for minors who have been trafficked, as well as immunity provisions. But the choices were made by the lead advocates, of which I am not the lead advocate, to actually cut the immunity provisions, go forward with the services, which are going to be fully funded by the governor's office on crime control and prevention, and then focus on the immunity provisions next session.
This is a really important point about trafficking because, I mean, clearly a crime has occurred, but one of the things that often has not been done, and it certainly you can talk more about this, is that the victim was also made to be a criminal. And it's hard to think about why that happened, but the victim would end up with a record.
Mm-hmm. Which affects employment and et cetera, et cetera.
Well, yes. And lots of things. And yeah, being locked up. And,
yeah, sure.
Right. So the fact that that both state and federal law, so state law says that a minor engaging in a commercial sex act is a victim of trafficking. State human trafficking law does not require that there's any proof of force, fraud, or coercion. So just being a minor under the age of 8, just being a minor engaged in a commercial sex act equals trafficking in the state of Maryland. However, those same minors can still be charged with and prosecuted for prostitution. And so there's conflict between
That's just downright weird, isn't it?
I mean, agree
those
with
are
you.
Just completely incompatible. Yeah.
And so that's where safe harbor laws came from, to basically address that conflict. And so Maryland has lagged significantly behind the rest of the country in addressing this conflict. So like I said, the first safe harbor law was passed in 2008. It is now 2019, and we still have not passed a full safe harbor law, despite the fact that we've had, I think it's been 4 years of work groups that are focused on, you know, figuring out the best way to implement this in Maryland, because every state is different. But yeah, I would agree that it's weird as well.
So in 2017, Baltimore Sun wrote a piece talking about the difficulty that prosecutors often had proving that a pimp used force, fraud, or coercion, and that that was absolutely necessary for a conviction. Therefore, there weren't a whole lot of convictions. And at that time, Maryland was one of two states with Nebraska where human trafficking could be charged as a misdemeanor. So are the actions that the General Assembly took just this past session addressing that kind of thing? Is it still considered by traffickers to be a pretty, you know, light tap on the wrist if they're caught?
So I am not a prosecutor. I want to just be upfront about that. But I don't know if I necessarily agree with that. I think, first of all, there is a lot of there's a profound misunderstanding of Maryland's human trafficking law. Unfortunately, we hear at the beginning of every session, every legislative session, from both people in the community and legislators that, oh, my goodness, trafficking is only a misdemeanor in the state of Maryland. That is legally inaccurate. Trafficking can be charged by prosecutors as a misdemeanor or as a felony. The misdemeanor charge for an adult does not require that a prosecutor prove that force, fraud, or coercion took place. So simply, this person was taken to this place knowing that the person was going to engage in prostitution, that is considered trafficking in Maryland. There are a lot of problems with that, in my opinion. We can go back to that. But prosecutors can charge a felony, but they would have to, at trial, prove that force, fraud, or coercion was used to get the adult to engage in the commercial sex act. If the victim that's identified as a minor, it's automatically charged as a felony, and there is no need for prosecutors to prove force, fraud, or coercion. Now, I know a lot of prosecutors, and again, so the prosecutors that I know can yell at me if they think I'm incorrect about this, but, you know, prosecutors use this misdemeanor law a lot of times in an attempt to not have to put a victim on the stand, to not have to, you know, basically re-traumatize a victim by having them tell their tale in front of a jury or in front of a judge, and it carries with it a 10-year sentence. So I don't know if I would say it's a slap on the wrist. So prosecutors do use that misdemeanor law, you know, in ways that are really helpful to them. The concern that I have with the fact that trafficking with the misdemeanor trafficking law, I should say, is that it criminalizes things that aren't trafficking. Essentially, if I take someone from point A to point B, knowing that that this person was going to engage in prostitution, even if I'm not trafficking them, right? So let's say I'm engaging in a commercial sex act, and so is my adult friend, and we travel together to stay safe, right? And to support each other. I have technically just committed the
Because you're the person transporting
exactly,
the other person.
Even though I'm not using any kind of force, any kind of fraud, or any kind of coercion. And instead, it's actually something that people engaging in the commercial sex trade do to stay safe, is that we work together so that, you know, I'm not alone and less vulnerable. So there are challenges. And, you know, like I said, I know prosecutors who have used this to put away traffickers that were definitely trafficking people in the state of Maryland. My concern is that, like I said, kind of misunderstanding that there is a felony provision always leads to an attempt at the beginning of every legislative session to make that misdemeanor section a felony. And for lack of a better term, it would then felonize things that aren't trafficking. And that can be extremely problematic and have a lot of unintended consequences for folks.
Well, there's been some suggestion in the literature, and the literature is all over the place, that there are many reasons why there's a lot of sex trafficking going on in Maryland, and we're going to get to those. But you've just pointed to one that suggests that the laws have been a little more lenient in Maryland. That might be one of the reasons why there's more sex trafficking here than in surrounding states.
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, in addition to location, you know, we're in between Washington and New York and all that.
And stuff. I didn't go into those.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
I mean, so I tend to, although I know that kind of situationally where Maryland is, I know that that plays a role. But trafficking is not about location. Trafficking is about vulnerability. Right. Where there is a vulnerable person, a person who needs a job, a person who needs to make money, who needs to pay the rent, who needs to feed their children, there unfortunately will be someone there to take advantage of that. And Maryland has all of that. Right. It has a thriving tourism area on the Eastern Shore. So there are tons of jobs. There are tons of people coming in from other countries looking for employment. There's poverty. There is
wealth.
You're right.
No, income disparity is an important part. We're a very wealthy state, right. And yet there are people who are...
There are pockets of significant poverty. Okay. And so Maryland has all of those vulnerability factors. And so in my opinion, that is why we have so much trafficking here in the state.
And the thing that Tom brought up is that, I mean, like with the drug trade, having all of these avenues of transportation is an important aspect.
Yeah, we've talked about the airports that are close, the, you know, the corridors that go south, west, north, et cetera.
Yeah.
And there was one statistic from the one of the hotlines that helps victims of sex trafficking, that there are somehow nationally about 450,000 kids who run away from home. And of those kids, like 1 in 6 will be put into sex trafficking within 48 hours. I mean, it just happens in a heartbeat.
Gets back to the dislocation you were talking about, that when you run away, even though you may be running away for very good reasons, you're still decontextualizing yourself. And that isolation makes you more vulnerable.
And then just being a minor, generally, forgetting all the other vulnerability factors, that makes you more vulnerable. And so if you're talking about minors who are running away, so runaway and homeless youth, if you're talking about LGBTQ young folks who are disproportionately represented within runaway and homeless youth, estimates are that even though LGBTQ persons make up 7 to 9% of the population, they may make up over 40% of all homeless youth. So when you're talking about young folks who are in and out of the child welfare system, you are taking away or you are limiting the possibility that this person has a supportive adult in their life. But one of the things that I think kind of links back to the legislation is that we don't hear a lot about labor trafficking because we didn't have a labor trafficking law until this session.
Yeah, just this year. All right, we'll pick it up there when we come back from a break. Jessica Emerson is the founder of the Human Trafficking Prevention Project at the University of Baltimore School of Law. It's Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks of MICA. She's the author of Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. We'll have more with Jessica Emerson and Sherry Parks when we come back. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. We are also streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, is there anything we can do about the deluge of robocalls that bludgeon our phones day in and day out? I'll speak with Raymond Tu. He's an assistant clinical professor of cybersecurity at the University of Maryland College Park. Jeffrey Fowler, he's a tech reporter for the Washington Post. And Maureen Mahoney, she's a policy analyst for Consumer Reports. So we'll talk about those horrible robocalls and all of your friends you just discovered from Azerbaijan tomorrow on Midday. If you've just joined us today, it's Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks. We're looking at the hidden realities of sex trafficking. In a 2014 report, the International Labor Organization estimated that human trafficking generated $150 billion in illegal profits per year. Trafficking and sexual exploitation is a vast and mostly hidden criminal enterprise that often goes unreported. Coming up in just a little bit, we're going to talk to Jean Alert. She works with victims of sex trafficking from around the country at the Samaritan Women Institute for Shelter Care. Jessica Emerson joins Sherry and me here in Studio A. She's the founder of the Human Trafficking Prevention Project at the University of Baltimore. And you can join our conversation as well at 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @midday WIPR. To follow me on Twitter, it's @TomHallWIPR, and you can also catch us on the WIPR Facebook page. So, Jessica Emerson, let's talk a little bit about, we just have this, you know, this organization called the International Labor Organization. Mm-hmm. So, you mentioned earlier that it's not just sexual exploitation, but it's labor exploitation, which even outpaces sexual exploitation. Talk about those two.
I would say far outpaces. So that the way that the TVPA defines trafficking is that they bifurcate it
and
into
TVPA
the Trafficking Victims Protection Act that you mentioned at the beginning. The federal law bifurcates the definition into sex and labor, both involving force, fraud, or coercion. Obviously, the added piece with the sex trafficking piece is that a minor under the age of 18 engaged in a commercial sex act is per se considered a victim of trafficking. But the messaging, by and large, is that sex trafficking is the most prevalent form of trafficking, when in fact it is not. And, you know, we were kind of talking about the messaging even in the state around all the prosecutions for sex trafficking. Well, we didn't have a labor trafficking law to prosecute folks under until this last legislative session. So there was a bill sponsored by Senator Susan Lee and Delegate Wanika Fisher, SB 689, HB 734. It was the Anti-Exploitation Act of 2019. And for the first time, we will have a law come October 1st that explicitly criminalizes labor trafficking in the state. And, you know, that's not my area of expertise, but what I believe is that, you know, the messaging is impacted, right? Because we're not hearing about any labor trafficking prosecutions. But I also think it is likely to have a chilling effect on the prosecution of labor trafficking crimes. Because if somebody is, you know, finding a labor trafficking crime in their jurisdiction and are not as plugged into this world as I am, they're going to go to the human trafficking law as it is currently written, and they're going to see only mentions of prostitution-related offenses.
And this is important to pull apart, because and in preparing for this, I read that there was much more sex trafficking, and it is true that there are more arrests for sex trafficking because there are laws. It's not
exactly
the incident, it's the arrest. And so it's important to pull this out. I think as a descendant of slaves, I think it is really interesting the lack of laws around forced labor and why they weren't there. Maryland was one of a very few states in the country where that law was not in place.
Yeah, slavery is alive and well. I mean, this is incredible. Give us an example of how someone gets entrapped in a labor exploitation situation. Is this kind of an indentured servitude situation where someone pays for transportation from somewhere and then, you know, they take the rest of their lives to try to pay it off? How does it work?
I mean, it can look a whole bunch of ways. What we commonly see are situations of what's called debt bondage. And that simply means, you know, maybe I pay someone to get me into this country, to smuggle me. We were talking about that before. So I pay to get smuggled over the border. Then this person here in this country holds my debt. And either I will work and they will keep adding to my debt for things that I never knew they would continue to add, or they don't apply what I earn because they say I owe them for, you know, sheets or food and, you know, those kind of things. And so I can never actually dig myself out from under my debt. It can look like someone who is hired to do domestic work, and the agreement is, you know, 5 days a week for 10 hours a day. And then the employer turns the tables on me and requires me to work 7 days a week for 16 hours a day and doesn't pay me. You know, it can look like someone who is hired for one thing, and then again, it turns out to be another. It can look a whole bunch of different ways, but again, we don't know what's happening in Maryland because we don't have a law to criminalize it.
People, I think, assume that the anti-slavery amendment took care of it, but it doesn't.
No.
We had a listener who couldn't stay on the line, but a caller named Rick asked a good question. What's the difference between trafficking and kidnapping?
Trafficking, again, involves the use of force, fraud, or coercion to induce someone to perform some form of labor, whether that be commercial sex or, you know, domestic servitude, working in a nail salon, who knows. Kidnapping is simply taking someone from their home or from the street and holding them somewhere. And it has nothing to do with any commercial aspect or having them perform some form of labor. I have seen kidnapping turn into trafficking. But again, if it's not around the use of force, fraud, or coercion to get someone to engage in some form of labor, that is what distinguishes trafficking from other offenses like kidnapping or even sexual assault.
Can one be charged with both?
I would assume so. Again, that's probably a better question for a prosecutor, but I don't see why not. Because the predicate, the first crime was the kidnapping, the second part was the trafficking.
Jessica Emerson is the founder of the Human Trafficking Prevention Project at the University of Baltimore School of Law. Sherry Parks is the director and vice president of strategic initiatives at MICA. We're talking about the terrible problem, which is particularly acute here in Maryland, of sex trafficking. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. And you can also ping us on the WYPR Facebook page. Would the legalization, Jessica Emerson, of sex work eliminate some or all of this problem? Because there are people who suggest that it would.
That is the kind of essential question among anti-trafficking activists. And I don't think that I can solve that for you here today. I want to be clear that there's a difference between legalization and decriminalization. So legalization would mean that someone would be taxed on their income. They would have to register in all likelihood.
In some places in Nevada.
Exactly. Right. Whereas decriminalization would focus on eliminating the criminalization of prostitution, for instance, if we're talking about sex trafficking. So basically saying that we will not be charging people with prostitution. I will tell you that through my work with the Human Trafficking Prevention Project, I can say for sure that decriminalization of prostitution does indeed harm our clients. The majority of the work that we do at the Human Trafficking Prevention Project is work with survivors of trafficking who have criminal offenses that stem from their involvement with their trafficker. Primarily, they're charged with prostitution. They're charged with a number of other misdemeanor, low-level offenses, and up to and including felony offenses. We also work with folks involved in the commercial sex trade who do not report having been trafficked, but their criminal records that stem from their involvement in the commercial sex trade make them more vulnerable to go on and be trafficked for the first time because, like you said at the beginning of the program, those criminal records impact folks from being able to obtain employment, being able to obtain housing, government benefits, furthering their education, and then the less concrete piece of simply being able to heal from something that has happened to them. And in 2011, Maryland became the second state in the entire country to pass what we call a criminal record relief law. In Maryland, it's called a vacature law or a vacating convictions law. And essentially what that is it allows a survivor of trafficking who has in the case of Maryland, a prostitution conviction on their record to petition the court to vacate or set aside that conviction, which is essential because helping anyone clean up their criminal record makes it more likely that they will go on and, you know, be able to obtain gainful employment and safe housing. But Maryland has lagged significantly behind the rest of the country since that point.
Yeah, you just wrote a report about how Maryland is among the worst in the nation when it comes to criminal records relief for sex traffickers.
I mean,
we really are behind in a big time.
Yep.
Way.
In March of this year, a report was published, co-authored by Polaris in Washington, D.C., the American Bar Association Survivor Reentry Project, Brooklyn Law School, and the University of Baltimore Law School. Basically, what we did was we graded all 50 states and the federal government on their criminal record relief law. We developed a rubric or a grading rubric based on our experience doing this work and with the feedback and impact and input of survivors of trafficking who had been criminalized. And of the states in the country, over 40 of them that have criminal record relief laws for adult survivors, Maryland ranked dead last. We got an F, and we didn't even get like a hard F, a soft F. We got a 27 out of 100. So that's a really hard F.
That'll flunk you where I went to school.
And this is not a question we can answer today, but what we're uncovering is this history in Maryland of not addressing this issue for some reason, and we don't know why, or we don't know who.
Yeah. And it feels to me, just in doing this work and having the legislative work be such a big part of what I do, that the state has kind of an endless appetite for legislation that will up the criminal penalties. But when it comes to addressing issues relating to the aftermath, like what happens after the person has been trafficked or has been identified, we seem to not be as concerned with that. I mean, just by virtue of the fact that the, you know, the immunity provision was knocked out of the safe harbor law, that this is the fifth year in a row that we have introduced improvements to Maryland's vacature law.
And you should explain that term.
Sure. Yeah. Well, so vacating convictions essentially means to allow someone to set aside a guilty verdict. There is an acknowledgement that it serves as an acknowledgement, I should say, that at that had the court known at the time the person appeared, you know, being charged with prostitution, that they were being trafficked at that moment, the court would have found them criminally not responsible for their actions, because the way that I like to explain it is the body did the act, but the mind didn't intend to, because the mind was being controlled by someone else. And it's essentially the theory of duress. So if I point a gun at you and tell you to go rob a store and you do it, your physical body did the thing, but you didn't intend to commit that crime. And you need to have both things in order to be criminally responsible for something under the law.
There's an interesting narrative, I think, developing here about the agency of the victim and just looking at that. Because one of the other trends that we're seeing nationally is the shift away from this being a crime against the state to a crime against a person. So the idea that this is a real person, and which means that they can turn around and sue in some states. Mm-hmm. So does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
And, you know, that actually has to deal with or relates to, I should say, what we called the recodification bill. It was SB 690, HB 871, sponsored by Senator Susan Lee and Delegate Jesse Pippi. Currently, the human trafficking law, which, as we all know now, doesn't include any labor provisions, sits within the prostitution subtitle of the Maryland Criminal Code. It is not a prostitution crime, right? It is a crime against a person, which is exactly what you just said. And as a result of this recodification bill...
So it's a crime of violence, essentially.
And that's actually a part of this. So this will move the human trafficking law out of the prostitution subtitle and into the crimes against persons title to recognize you're right that it's not a crime against the state. It's not a prostitution crime. It is a crime against a person. That law actually includes a provision that will then, again, when it is enacted in October, make felony trafficking a crime of violence.
And Jessica Emerson, I know we have to let you go. You've got a thing at 1 o'clock that you've got to race down to school for. So I appreciate your being here very, very much and look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you.
Jessica Emerson is the founder of the Human Trafficking Prevention Project at the University of Baltimore School of Law. Coming up after a quick break, we'll speak with the director of an organization that works with victims of sex trafficking, and we'll take your calls and comments. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayWYPR. You can also ping us on the WYPR Facebook page. It's Midday Culture Connections. Dr. Sherry Parks is the Vice President of Strategic Initiatives at the Maryland Institute College of Art. She's also the host of the 7th Annual Baltimore Thinkathon, which takes place at MICA on Thursday from 9 to 4:30. Every year, Sherry invites the creative community and social justice activists to brainstorm solutions to problems facing Baltimore. This event is presented in cooperation with the Greater Baltimore Cultural Alliance, and we've got a link to more information on our website, wypr.org/midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station.
And welcome back. It's Midday Culture Connections. I'm Tom Hall here in Studio A with Dr. Sherry Parks of the Maryland Institute College of Art. We're discussing the enormous criminal enterprise of sex trafficking. Because of our place on the I-95 corridor, among other reasons, the Baltimore metropolitan area includes many, many women and men who are being trafficked. Last year, the National Human Trafficking Hotline reported more than 5,000 cases nationwide. More than 4,200 of those cases involved women, 1,400 were minors, and more than 800 were U.S. citizens. You can join our conversation at 410-662-8780. You can send us an email, midday@wypr.org. You can drop us a tweet, and you can catch us on the WYPR Facebook page. Now joining us on the line from her offices in the Baltimore area is Jean Alert. She's the executive director of the Samaritan Women for Shelter Care, a Christian organization that works on the rehabilitation of victims of sex trafficking from Maryland and around the country. Jean, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tom.
So tell us, who are the victims? Who are the people that you're working with?
When we started our organization 12 years ago, we decided from the get-go we were going to take survivors from anywhere in the United States, and that has proven to be very effective for us and for the survivors because we've learned that relocating them, first, these individuals are often persona non grata. They don't really belong anywhere after having been trafficked for a while. And two, relocating out of areas of known victimization radically improves their healing trajectory. So while we're located in Baltimore, we do take survivors from now over 23 different states across the United States.
And Jean, I wonder if you'd let us go to the phones. We have a caller, Janet, on the line. Janet, welcome to Midday.
Hi. I assume that sex trafficking in Maryland has been going on for a long time. And many years ago, when I was a student, I discovered an ad for what was called Maid Services, and so I needed some employment. So I called the number, and I was told that it was a topless maid service, and that I would get a little uniform with a little skirt and some kind of a little maid's hat and a feather duster, and no top, and that's what the job would be. And you know, I would only spend a short time with a client, and so I was wondering if this kind of ad could lead to a girl or woman being entrapped in sex trafficking.
All right. Well, thanks for that call, Janet. I mean, Jean Alert, is this the kind of story that you've heard from some of the people you've worked with?
I think it's not uncommon for employment advertising to be one of the ploys for recruitment. It can sometimes be in the music business. It can sometimes be in the hospitality arena. Home health services is another area. And for those individuals, like the caller, where it's an economic driver, that is going to be the bait that is going to at least introduce them to some potential victims.
Well, and it's interesting because that was a media-based ad, and jump forward to the present, where the internet has been really, really important. That one estimate is 87% of the solicitations now are internet, even though there's been some recent, Craigslist voluntarily pulls some down and some others were pulled down. So we have to wait and see where that energy goes. But the media are really important to this.
Sure. And Jean Alert, what does it take to rehabilitate a person who has been the victim of sex trafficking? What's the process?
Well, it takes a tremendous amount of time because what we've learned over the last decade is that largely what we attend to in terms of trauma has more to do with the wounds of childhood compounded by the exploitation within trafficking. 94% of our victim population were victims of childhood sexual abuse. 70% of them came from fatherless homes. 87% came from homes that were substance abusing. And so a lot of dysregulation. We see probably upwards of 60% have been in the foster care system. And so we really look at this as complex trauma, which means that it's over a sustained period of time, in many cases their life, in a relational context. And so another critical component to healing is to be able to affect community in their lives. These are individuals who are very isolated from society. The grooming process isolates, and then the victimization process keeps them further separate from society and in a mindset that they don't belong anywhere. So we have to invert the pathology of that and accentuate the importance of community. So by virtue of example, one of the things that we do from the very beginning is our ladies engage in volunteering in the community. And they go all over Baltimore doing various volunteering activities, but it is a great way for them to see that they can make a social contribution. They are not carrying the stigma of what society or what they may think society thinks of them. They have value, they have worth, and they also develop relational connections.
One of the aspects of your care is that it is long-term. Most programs are short-term. How long is the average term at your institute?
So right now, statistically, our average length of stay is about 19 months. Our program was initially designed to be 2 years, and then we quickly expanded it to 4 years. But I'll say even that is sort of loose because we've had women that have been with us 5 years. In some cases, women have moved from elsewhere in the country, and they're making Baltimore their new home.
And is the establishment of community also, does it happen with between the victims? I mean, as they because I assume you're dealing with groups of people at a time. We're not going to talk about where you're located or anything, but you have more than one or two victims at a time in a residential program in your institute. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And so, yes, we are group living, if you frame it that way. But let me say that the most critical value that we bring in terms of advancing community is we use a tremendous amount of volunteers. So we are a disclosed location. It's a bit of a sometimes Hollywood overstatement to think that this is all has to be done in this secrecy when socially what we're trying to do is help these individuals reenter. So we use a tremendous number of volunteers. Our survivors, on average, interact with 12 community volunteers every week, and that's drivers, tutors, instructors in our schoolhouse, people who are giving them enrichment lessons, leading Bible study, taking them places, serving as professionals in whatever context, might be therapeutic, medical, et cetera. So our ladies have a tremendous amount of interaction with the greater community.
And your garden is an aspect of the healing process?
I would love to tell you that that is true. because I'm from the Midwest, and I would love to think that that was the ideal. But the honest truth is, that's never really taken off. For some of our women who've been very urban or grown up in institutional living, the outdoors is intimidating, and so we have to move slowly with that. So we might start with some potted plants or maybe a little raised bed garden. But it has not proven to be as much of a component of the healing process as we would like.
And in terms of people recognizing the signs that someone they know might be being trafficked, what advice would you give to people, and what would you tell them to do? To whom could they report that information? How could they intervene to help a person they fear might be a victim?
Well, I'm sure you've heard the statistic that the average age of recruitment is between 11 and 13 or 12 to 14, but right in that middle school age. And so if we're going to hone in on that, we have to look first and foremost at truancy. We have to look at the child appearing perhaps in states of distress, in states of maybe additional gifts. Maybe some physical signs, bruises, those types of things. And so we might look for a pattern of the child is in school for a while and then is gone for a while and then is back again. Or maybe the child drops out completely. We've had a number of women who just stopped going to school right around eighth grade. And I always ask, you know, was there no truancy officer? Was there nobody coming to the home to find out where you were? And that's infrequent. So we have to look at a couple of things. We have to look at changes in a pattern, and that could apply to adults as well. If somebody begins to become more secretive about their life, almost as if they're leading a double life, which can often be true, if the individual is being presented with gifts or clothing or outings or things like that that seem atypical for their situation, that can be common in the grooming phase, that it's very, the number one ploy is really the romance ploy. And so she may be in a situation where she is being groomed and lured with all kinds of attraction and favor, but that script is going to flip at some point. I would say being secretive about their contacts. So the person might start carrying a second cell phone. They might not be introducing new friends to their existing friends. We have to just look at the large umbrella concept of increasing isolation and secrecy. But and that will be in the grooming phase, and then usually the person just then disappears from that situation.
Yeah, and this grooming phase, as you say, begins incredibly young. These are children in middle school.
Yeah, it really does, and that's why I'm glad you brought up the online universe, because the social media is the number one channel. A lot of the apps that the children have access to that the parents, frankly, are not as aware of or know how to navigate are primary channels for recruitment, and that can be a very slow and nefarious approach. It can be engendering a relationship with that child. If we consider the number of kids that we have that are in unstable housing situations or inconsistent with parenting or parental supervision, there are individuals who would gladly move into that place in that child's life. And we often don't know who else is speaking into our child's life.
That's for sure. Boy, vigilance for parents is and perhaps never been more important. Quick comment before we have to call it a day here, Sherry.
Well, I mean, as people are listening to this, who are citizens, how would you suggest that they help?
Well, awareness is key. We advocate that awareness needs to start in the home. And so a parent needs to turn to your child, as awkward as it might be, and say, what do you know about this issue? And let the child speak. It's probably a fair bet that the kid knows something about this. And maybe it's not sex trafficking, but do you know kids that have to do things that they wouldn't want to do? Do you know anybody in your school that you think is in danger? Is there anybody that's doing bad stuff or with bad people that worries you? And, you know, it may not be your child, but it might be the children that your child goes to school with. And there's talk, and they're aware. And an open dialogue is a tremendous safeguard. You know, time and time again, we see that if only the child had one safe person in their life that they could go to, a parent, a coach, a teacher, a guidance counselor, clergy, somebody that they could go to when the early warning signs of danger were present.
Gina Lurd is the executive director of the Samaritan Women for Shelter Care. If you'd like to help, we've got a link to their website on our website, wypr.org/midday. Thank you, Gina. I very much appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Sherry Parks is the Vice President of Strategic Initiatives at MICA. She's the author of Fierce Angels, Living with the Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. She joins us for Midday Culture Connections the first Tuesday of the month. She also hosts Beyond the Ballot here on WIPR. By the way, Gina Lurd and Sherry Parks were both inducted into the Daily Record's Top 100 Maryland Women in a ceremony last night at the Meyerhoff. So congratulations to you both. We want to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch today. Joe Squared has been recently recognized by the Daily Meal. Menu and hours at joesquared.com. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to talk about robocalls and how to prevent them. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for joining us today. Have a great day.